Welcome to episode 35 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Been taking it a little bit easier over the summer with the podcast, but something popped up today that really prompted me to do another episode, and that is just today a new volume of the Foreign Relations of the United States series from the State Department was released on Central America between 1977 and 1980. If you've read my blog, you may have known that I'm a big fan of Froese, and this goes back for me really a long time. Back when I was getting a master's degree in political science at San Diego State University, so literally now 25 years ago, Brian Loveman, who was a political scientist there, now retired, introduced everybody in one in a U.S. Latin America class, a graduate seminar, introduced everybody to the series, and actually had an assignment where you had to go and do a project based on those documents. And this was it was great for me. It was eye-opening. I didn't know anything about the sorts of primary documents that were available. And ultimately, actually for me, they became the core of my master's thesis, which looked at recognition policy toward Latin America, which then much later I ended up actually getting published in Presidential Studies Quarterly. And Froese isn't perfect, you know. It's there's a lot of stuff that it doesn't have, you know, and you need to corroborate it with other sources or whatever. But it's just this tremendous way of getting some immediate insights into what the U.S. State Department was telling its ambassadors, and then what they were saying back, and then all of these different reports from different people in the U.S. government also get intermixed with that, and all of these accounts of meetings are just fascinating to read. And of course, the best thing about it nowadays is that it's all available free, no paywall, online through the State Department. And actually, you can go back to old issues. I don't remember exactly how far back they have them digitized, but the University of Wisconsin has a bunch of them digitized that go back a long time. The series itself goes back until I think it is 1861. But nowadays, you don't have to go to a university library like I did at the time and have these really huge, dusty old volumes, which actually back then you couldn't even check out. You can get them all online. You can actually get them in easy format for e-readers. So this is just kind of a little poke that if you're unfamiliar with this series, then I strongly urge you to go take a look. Now, if you want something that's recent, you know, it's not going to work because there's a delay of several decades before they start making all of this public. So the fact that the series is just slowly creeping into the Reagan administration, that's just kind of how it goes. But overall, I'm always kind of nerdy excited when a new volume is coming out. So I was taking a look, appropriately enough, in summer, so that you know, things aren't quite as hectic as they are during the semester. And going through, there was a few things that popped up at me. And so the first, I mentioned this just really briefly on Twitter, but the first is that if you do a search of the volume, which is over 1,000 pages, there's, I think, three mentions of immigration total, and these are rather offhand, and that just really struck me because actually it also made me think that I can't wait till we get to the Central America volumes on the Reagan administration, which unfortunately right now are just listed as being researched, so I don't know how many years it'll take for them to come out. But now, of course, we understand that U.S. policy towards Central America, as the Salvadoran Civil War in particular began to heat up, that our policy had a direct impact on the decision of Central Americans to leave. There had not been much of a migrant stream from El Salvador prior to the 1980s, and then it exploded. And obviously the civil war in Guatemala also intensified in the 1980s. But you don't see, policymakers aren't, they're not thinking about it at all. They're not thinking about the possibility that some of these policies are going to have this human impact that would affect the U.S. Now, the only out that you could potentially give to Reagan administration officials, Bob Pastor being in many ways as a national security person for Latin America in particular, you could give them an out because the U.S. was holding back, really, and still sort of feeling out the situation in Nicaragua and El Salvador. And so as the Carter administration ended, they were handing off these two things that you could have, you could have a very hardline response, which everybody knew the Reagan administration was going to take, or you could continue with a more moderate one. Though to be fair, also the Carter administration officials were wondering how much longer a moderate position would have worked. But as yet, the U.S. wasn't deeply involved. But by the time we get to the early 1980s, when President Reagan takes office, then that changes drastically. And of course, everybody knew that was going to change. The Salvadoran generals, as is pointed out in a couple of documents in this volume, were extremely happy that that Reagan was elected, because they figured mostly correctly that he was going to give them a much better deal than Carter. But I want to know, like, was anybody thinking about this at all? My guess, obviously, is no. This is the sort of thing that is an unintended consequence, but it is a foreseeable consequence, but nobody foresees it. It's reminded me too of research that I've been doing with my dad. And for those of you who don't know, my dad, now a professor emeritus, but is a demographer, and we were looking at the ability of governments to really raise spending and subsidies, Venezuela being one case, but also Chile in the Allende years and the late 60s leading into the Allende years, you know, how much demography actually was an impediment to being able to have a sustainable increase in government spending. And demography will have a huge impact on that, because your demographic structure, your age structure, is going to tell you, you know, how many young people, working age people you have versus older people, and also versus young children who are still dependent. And nobody who's been talking about demography, nobody thinks about it. At the policymakers, I should say, in the Chilean case, I know too from talking to people that there are demographers there working for CEPAL, and also working in the Chilean government, and nobody listened to them. So the policymakers weren't really interested. So I just find it fascinating, in the case coming back to this volume, that nowadays we strongly associate Central America and migration. That's like the dominant thing, besides maybe drugs. But you go back to the late 70s, and nobody is making these kinds of connections at all. And then later, it's going to be somehow this big surprise, when in fact, of course, it really should not have been a surprise at all. Now, the other thing that popped out at me was was an imperfect, but I think still interesting comparison to Anastasio Somoza and his reaction to U.S. policy back then to Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela today. I blogged about this today, and reading more, it's really interesting how this really cuts through ideology. Now the cases are different for a number of reasons, ideology being a big one, but the other big one being that in the Nicaraguan case, it wasn't that Somoza was making public statements or things. He was talking to the U.S. ambassador almost constantly, which of course Maduro is not. So in some cases, what Somoza saw as direct pressure really was direct pressure. It wasn't a joke. It wasn't a conspiracy theory. Is that the United States was pushing him to try to do a number of things to actually be more moderate. And for a number of reasons, he was incapable, unwilling to do that. But what was similar between the two cases, the two people, two leaders, and it might really be things that are shared by any really embattled leader who has been, in Maduro's case, shrinking democratic space drastically, or in the case of Somoza, squeezing off what tiny amount that there had been in the first place. But there's a lot of whining. So that Somoza was telling the ambassador, who was Mauricio Solaun, that he wished the U.S. government would, quote, stop picking on me and this small country. You know, it's all about being picked on. You have the bully. And the U.S. is obviously often playing the part of a bully, though in this case, really all the U.S. was doing was trying to get him to accept some opposition presence in the government and to really pull back on what was his complete power over the country, which is also one difference between these two cases, because Maduro does not have personal power over the entire country, and certainly doesn't have complete control over the military either. But also that Somoza was trying to play the OAS. So, and what's funny, in multiple places, is that Somoza just tells the U.S., I've got the dictators on my side. He says this multiple times. And this is the sort of the flip of Venezuela being able to count on the support of some governments of the left, with Ecuador and Bolivia being right at the forefront, but being able to count on them for support. Now, interestingly enough, the Venezuelan government now sees its position as weak enough that it says it wants to get out of the OAS. Somoza never said that. He was just trying to make sure that he was getting the support of the dictators. And so in both cases, both then and now, we had the United States trying to push for a visit from the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights and have some sort of OAS presence in mediating the dispute. And in both cases, with Maduro today and Somoza back then, the government was refusing, and then blaming the United States for having politicized this excessively, for having not understood the situation, et cetera, et cetera. And in the case of Somoza, there's actually a really tremendous irony, because Somoza was mad at Venezuela. So back then, back in the late 1970s, Venezuela was leading the way to pressure Somoza to step aside, to democratize Nicaragua. And President Carter had visited Venezuela, and he was really unhappy about it. What he said was that, he would be willing to listen to a number of different issues, but not the issue of a visit by the commission from the American Commission of Human Rights. And he said that that a problem with that is because of the pressure mounted on him by Venezuela. And he said, quote, he was no fool, and that he was not going to let himself be embarrassed or screwed. So he was actually mad at Venezuela for having taken a very pro-democratic, pro-human rights position. And now, of course, we see almost 30 years later that Venezuela is doing pretty much the exact opposite. And then he also talks about how he doesn't really want to allow a Human Rights Commission to visit Nicaragua because, quote, he has to make new friends among the Latin America dictators. So he said this just straight out. I have to make friends with dictators, and so I cannot have I can't allow any Human Rights Commission in because, quote, I may need them someday. So we have this sort of strange parallels between the two cases, where you have these leaders who are facing severe crises. It's much different for Somoza. He was facing an armed insurrection. No matter what you want to call the more extreme parts of the opposition in Venezuela, that's not really what's happening there. But in both cases, you've got an increasingly isolated regime that's hanging on, that's undemocratic, and that is really pushing back against the U.S. and against the region, blaming them really for what's going on, and not so much itself, though Somoza's much more open than Maduro in talking about the nature of the governments that still support him. What kind of comes also from that flows from that, was, and I blog about this today, was the fact that the Latin American Studies Association chose not to have a statement condemning the actions of the Venezuelan government, saying that it would be too partisan and too one-sided, and so that it said that they needed to have it more historicized and add context, and then, you know, which basically means to make sure that you blame the opposition equally as you do the government. And I had blocked today that doesn't make sense to me, really, because the state in any situation has far more power than civil society, except like in extreme cases. And so the state with that monopoly over power bears far more responsibility right off the bat than civil society does. But I also think, too, is that back then, back in the late 1970s, at a time when dictatorships reigned across so many Latin American countries, it was critical for the OAS and critical for the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights to take a principled stand against dictatorship. And was this perfect? No. Would it be applied differently across different countries? Almost certainly yes. But that doesn't mean that that you can't criticize governments that really are abusing human rights. And of course, the Carter administration had been widely applauded by leftist governments. But what it was doing is it was speaking out against human rights, and you know, and this is the sort of thing, basically my argument, is that this is the sort of thing that we should also applaud now, as imperfect as it might be, but it's the state that's responsible for the vast majority of the abuse of human rights. It's the state that has control over the entire administrative apparatus of the country. And so that's really what's responsible. So this sort of parallels are I think kind of odd, but but illustrative because there's a lot of similarities between the two cases. And with that, I am going to sign off. And so I'll still be doing podcasts throughout the summer, at least periodically, as things sort of pop up. And so just stay tuned. It might not be weekly, but there'll certainly be some more throughout the summer.